Hi there, and welcome to the Growing Opportunities podcast series. I am Michelle Roberge.
And I am Megan Darcy.
We are the agriculture coordinators for the regional district of Bulkley Chaco.
We are small-scale farmers with a keen interest in agriculture, and we're excited to be using this format to communicate information about regional agriculture to the broader community. This podcast series will touch on different agriculture topics important to new farmers and producers wanting to diversify their farm operations.
If you have questions about these podcasts or anything agriculture in the regional district, please go to rdbn.bc.ca, click on the agriculture link, and you'll find our contact information there.
We hope that you enjoy this podcast series on growing opportunities in the RDBN.
The RDBN is providing this podcast as a public service. It is neither a legal interpretation nor a statement of government policies. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the RDBN. The views expressed by staff and guests are their own and do not represent the opinion of the RDBN or any of its directors. Presenters are not subject matter experts, and information presented should be verified by certified professionals prior to informing business or legal decisions.
Michelle Roberge is a producer from Vanderhoof. She and her family own and operate Bioscape Farm, a mixed livestock and horticulture operation. The farm and homestead both operate off-grid. Welcome, Michelle.
Hi, Megan. Thank you.
Could you give us a brief description of your farming operation?
Well, we are located in Vanderhoof, just northeast of Vanderhoof. And we have about just over 300 acres of mixed, a great mix of habitats, if you want to call them, areas. So we have some fields, some forest, a lot of wetlands. Chilcoe Creek goes through the bottom end of one of our fields. And so we have this like great natural gully there that we look at but don't usually go down because it's really steep, and it's just a really lovely piece of property. And that's where we have sheep and cattle and pigs and all the different kind of birds, and then I also have a greenhouse and a very large vegetable garden.
Oh, that sounds lovely. And we've talked about you owning bees too. Have you owned bees in the past?
Oh yes, thanks. I don't have bees right now, but I have had bees, and I have a couple of my kids who essentially live off honey. So bees are an important part of our farm.
That's nice. Yeah. So it sounds like it's a pretty diverse operation. Why did you guys decide to go off grid?
We're both biologists. We like natural habitats. We like animals. There's a lot of agricultural land and we were in Vanderhoof already. So in the area that have established farms and are all powered up already. And so we thought, okay, well, you know, it'd be nice, but it's, you know, we understand that might not happen. But then we happened upon our piece of property, and it just, all the stars aligned essentially. And based on the distance of our property from the closest power line, existing power line, it was not only initial, you know, choice to do it, but it was out of necessity actually, because it was just going to be too costly to bring power into where we wanted to put the house. So that's how it happened essentially.
Cool. Can you describe the off-grid system that you're using?
We considered, you know, all the different options, right? So there's the two main ones being wind power and solar power. Even though wind power is a nice option because you can generate power any time of day, the you know, looking at weather and sort of our location, we don't think we would have had a like nice consistent amount of wind to provide power consistently. So, and being in the north, we have lots of clear winter days and whatnot. And so we went with solar, and we have 16 panels. And then we have a battery bank. So we have a 48 volt system. Our family was small. We have 5 kids. And so we just didn't know how much power we'd be using. So we wanted to set up the system so it was, you know, as basic and easy to maintain as possible. So they're fixed. They face directly south, and they're really high up. So we get really good sun coverage when the sun is out.
Yeah, that makes sense, because Vanderhoof's basically up on a plateau, right? So you would be able to get good exposure.
Yeah, and we're up. We're not down in the valley bottom, like the Nishaka. We're not within the floodplain or anything. We're up higher on the bench, other than like the lowest, you know, the shortest days of the year when the sun is the lowest on the horizon. We get a little bit of shade on the panels, but other than that, you know, they get no shade. And so they get really good coverage.
Do you guys have a backup in case you don't have enough power to run the farm and the household?
Yeah, absolutely. So we do have a generator. So we run it when we need it, essentially. So if we've had days of clouds, or if there's been a lot of showers or laundry get done when the sun wasn't out, then yeah, we definitely have to run the generator. Once we get a new battery system, I think the reliance on the generator will go significantly down.
Right. That makes sense. So what have you found to be the biggest challenges for setting up the system and for maintaining it?
The setting up was just finding someone who knows a lot about it, right? And who was able to support us. And we did find that person, but it was, you know, just a guy who it was a bit of his hobby. I think there are now established businesses, you know, locally that definitely can support setting up solar systems or wind or geothermal or all the different options. Deciding on, you know, how big the system should be was a lot of, you know, math and guesswork, and we did a pretty good job. You know, we haven't really struggled. You know, we've only lost power a handful of times, and that was just because we were being lazy and didn't, you know, knew that we were low on power, but we're too lazy to go turn the generator on. And then, you know, early on when we had smaller generators that didn't have quite enough oomph, but were inexpensive, we had issues in the cold and starting them. And there were some panic moments there where we were on the verge of losing power and couldn't get the generator started, and et cetera, et cetera. So we probably would have had a lot less stress if we had put the money out to get sort of a better generator right off the top. But, you know, we were building a house and there were a lot of other expenses and whatnot. So they're just choices you make, right? But yeah. So, you know, not a lot of challenges, but definitely, you know, that alternate power when the solar isn't working. And that's the biggest challenge.
So just to get an idea of what the capacity of the solar system is, you use it to power the house and the hot water tank, is that right?
Not the hot water tank. It's the water pump. That's the biggest power consumption is the water pump. So we have a well, and it's that the pump to get the well to the house. So that's the biggest consumption. Everything is on power bars. And so when you're not using it, like there's so much phantom power that TVs and computers take while even when they're turned off. Same with the computers. Yeah, the only thing that stays on all the time is the router for Wi-Fi. That's pretty much the only thing that stays on. But it does run our fridge. So we have an electric fridge. We didn't do propane, but we did propane hot water. And we do have a cook stove. So we have a wood cook stove. So we don't have an electric stove or a propane stove. We use wood because we live in a forest and we have lots of still some dead pine and trees that fall over. So we just take what the forest gives us. You know, we have almost 5 teenagers now and there's a lot of banging on the bathroom door to get out of the shower because they're taking too long.
And so from the farm point of view, what do you use for power for the farm? Like the lights and do you run heat lamps and stuff?
We do. So when we have chicks, we don't have the red heat lamps because they take a lot of power. They take 250 watts. So we have the radiant heat heat plates for our chicks, and they take 40 watts. We set up our farms or our barn, sorry, so that where the chickens are, it's all insulated and we don't have any secondary heat in there. So it's really just body heat that that keeps the chickens good for the winter. We do have water going to the barn, and so we have a tap inside the barn, and we've learned through a lot of trial and error that one power thing, heat source that we do have is just a little bit of heat tape on the water tap in the barn. It will freeze. We sometimes bring pigs into the section of the barn where the water is and just keep a couple pigs inside that area for the winter because their body heat really makes a difference. Like, it's amazing when you just throw a couple bodies in there. For watering animals, it's just, we don't have water heaters. It's just chipping ice and you know, giving less water more often so that there's less chance for it to freeze. At this point, you know, if the kids have to choose between having a decent length shower versus having to go give the kettle a bit of water a few more often, they choose the showers.
Right. Yeah. I found that when I was doing some research, it's interesting because it feels like we've gone from a time when solar panels were kind of rare and very expensive to a time when, but the people who were handling them were really knowledgeable, to a time when now the technology seems to be more commonplace. But now it's a bit confusing when your average consumer goes to try and figure out what you should be buying and how the system works. And so really, it still feels like you need some expertise that you can't just, you know, buy it off Amazon or something like that and install it yourself. Although, I mean, admittedly, I haven't tried, but it feels like there's a lot of product out there, but that it's not so straightforward how to figure out how to put it all together.
And that's true. That's true. Even like I said earlier, we have to replace our batteries and just the options, right? And I mean, I think we're going to go to a lithium battery because I think one lithium battery can replace our 8 lead acid batteries. So the advantage of that is multifold. It takes way less space, and so we regain a bunch of space in a building that houses our batteries. The lead acid batteries create all sorts of toxic off-gassing, and so they're in a box that's continually vented out, so we have that fan running all the time, which sucks power. It's a small fan, but still, it's power. Like, I look at everything as, okay, what is this taking away from, you know, other conveniences, right? So so with the lithium, you don't have to, it doesn't have any off gassing, and so it can just sit there on a shelf, right? And so we can eliminate that fan and just that sort of risk of those fumes being, you know, not necessarily making it outside, but actually entering the space, right? So, and then, you know, lithium batteries, you can draw them way farther down before they have to recharge. But our batteries, you only can, the lead acid batteries, you can only draw them down so much. And then they have to recharge. So at this point, because they're older batteries, and we've treated them well, but we made a couple mistakes along the way, which we're paying for. So it's just learning, right? You know, we can't let them get below like 85% capacity before we have to charge them. So we can't go multiple days anymore, multiple cloudy days. We have to charge, you know, at least at night or also in the morning, depending. But with the lithium batteries, you can draw them almost all the way down and then charge them. So you get just so much more time. And that's why, you know, that's why I said earlier that our reliance on the generator will go significantly down, which makes me feel better because, you know, I have this idea like being off grid, we're doing all these great things. And then I turn on a gas generator and it kind of makes me a little bit sick to my stomach. Right. But knowing that we only turn it on if we have to, and, you know, the goal here soon within the next year is to get that new battery system. So, you know, we'll use that generator way less.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I think we're coming to the end of our interview here, but I just wanted to know if you had any pearls of wisdom for the listeners.
Pearls of wisdom. Well, I guess if you have the opportunity to do a lot of, you know, obviously research, but just pre-plan how you want to have your animals and where you're going to water them and, you know, how to set all those kind of logistics up, so that you're setting yourself up to use as little power as possible. And if you're able to do that, then great. We did a bit of that, but then, you know, obviously made mistakes and then figured out a system that we use very little power. And we just use animal heat and those kind of things. So just got to be a little clever about how you set up, especially overwintering. In the summer, it doesn't matter. The summer, there's tons of sun and it's really not an issue, but it's just that over the winter, which we have a lot of, right? And then another pearl of wisdom, I guess, is just, you know, just do it. Like it's, you know, really consider it, really consider alternate ways of, you know, creating your own power or using less power. I mean, hydropower is really clean. And so we're fortunate in BC to have hydroelectric power. But there are costs still to that. And so just using, just always sort of looking at ways to just reduce your power consumption is always a benefit. Even if you're fully on the grid, you just have smaller bills, right? And it might not take a lot of effort to do that.
Well, and we're on grid, and I find that not having any backup is kind of a problem. Like, because when the power goes down, you don't have a pump for water, and you don't have, you don't have any heat. So, you know, the worst case scenario for us is in the early spring when the winds come through and the power goes down and there's just chicks in the barn, then all of a sudden they're out of heat. And it's not even so much the heat, which is also important, but it has to do with like the fact that they sometimes pile because they're scared because all of a sudden the lights just went out. So yeah, there's definite considerations to being on grid, even if you live in a rural area where your power lines may or may not be subject to trees falling on them when the wind picks up. So yeah, I mean, it's not, there's probably no perfect system, I guess, but maybe a good idea would be to have be interesting to see what it would take to have a solar backup, right?
Oh, absolutely. I have to say that it's, you know, I feel kind of bad sometimes because there'll be a big windstorm and, you know, the power will be out in town and everybody's on Facebook going, oh, I can't get a coffee and blah, blah, blah. And we're at our house and we're warm because we've got the fire going and we have power because we don't have any lines going to our house. And you know, aesthetically speaking only, it's really nice not to have any overhead lines and you know, those hazards to worry about, right? Like I sometimes I'm like, oh, sorry everybody, but we're good. Or I won't know that there's power and we don't look at Facebook in the morning and we can't just, you know, get to town. We're like, what's going on here? This is crazy. But that's happened a couple times.
Well, we all know which house to go to when there's a big power outage, eh? You have to have a pot of coffee on. Okay, well, thank you very much, Michelle. That sounds really interesting, and I really appreciate you sharing your information with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me today.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
I'd like to introduce my next guest, Brian Swansburg. Brian and his wife own 60 acres just outside of Smithers. They grow grain, vegetables, fruit, and hay. Welcome, Brian. Tell me a little bit about your farm.
Being in the agricultural land reserve, I think you can definitely call the 60 acres a farm, but only 20 acres of that are really under cultivation of any sort. It's really just pasture. And about 2 acres we do intensively with, basically small, what would we call it? Market garden would be the best term, I think. And then the fruit trees for our own usage. And anything left over, we certainly sell off to our local neighbors who are interested.
And do you have some alternative energy systems on your farm, is that correct?
Yeah. I remember reading once a fellow who said that the alternative energy systems were his diesel engines. And I kind of feel that way. The only thing we're using right now directly using fossil fuels as our tractor. Doesn't mean we're not using fossil fuels. Every once in a while a chainsaw comes out, but we are on grid, so we're using the BC Hydro system as our battery for the winter when things get dark and cold. But we're also collecting solar power, which is leaves us with a net zero electricity usage for the year. Things we're using that electricity for, we do have an electric car, a hybrid, which generally doesn't use much gasoline because we're doing short trips with it. All of our shop tools are electric, of course, including things like chainsaw. Also on the initial build when we did the house, we put in a biogas digester. At the time, it's a Chinese system made by Puxin. And at the time, I think it was the coldest one that had been installed. There was a few in like Norway and stuff, but they tend to be a slightly warmer climate than here. So when we installed it, we stuck it a greenhouse on top of it to keep it warm for the winter. And we've been pretty pleased with our natural gas production.
Oh, what have you been able to grow in the greenhouse?
Greenhouse generally lives tomatoes for the summer. It is well insulated, and we definitely have, like, we still haven't had frost in there. Because of where we live here, winter light is really not appropriate to get anything to grow in there. You'd need to put grow lights in to get your plants to do anything. So really what we're using that extra shoulder season warmth for is things like storing spinach, right? So it'll grow in September, October, and it just sort of lives in there until November, December when it gets eaten. Then likewise in the spring, we can usually get some spinach growing early. We'll maybe start things in the house where it's really warm. For the most part, even with the insulation in the greenhouse, we don't really have a very long growing season in there.
Oh, that's really interesting. What do you use the methane for that comes out of the biodigester?
So yeah, it's the biogas is not like true natural gas. It has about a 30% component of carbon dioxide, but that actually just goes straight through whatever you're burning. For us, all we have wired up is a stove. So we have a 2-burner gas stove and a 2-burner electric stove. So far, we haven't had everything quit at once. So generally, we use the gas stove because it's free. cooking isn't a huge expense, but you might as well use it when it's free.
Right. Is there equipment available that if you wanted to use the methane, say, to heat a small building or a small space or something like that, is that technology available?
Oh, absolutely. We are very low maintenance at our place. You probably know that there's a few, I think there may be up to 100 people now in BC doing commercial size biogas systems. Probably the best known one is on the road to Sumas, border crossing. But there you can plug your electric car in and run off the biogas from dairy farm waste, and then they feed back to the grid with that. So there's certainly dozens of people doing that here in BC. Now, ours is a small one. It's called the Family Size Digester, which I love the same name of that. And we don't have any livestock, so we're basically just two animals. And you poop in the digester, and it produces gas for us to cook on. But ours is basically zero maintenance, and we have cooking ability for about 350 days of the year, probably.
I was just going to ask if you add any compost or anything like that.
Yeah, not much. Usually a batch of grass in the spring. And then it just lives on human excrement for the rest of the summer. The system does come with a two-burner stove, a rice cooker, which works very well, those Coleman-type lanterns, which are the really good Chinese ones that are radioactive. And then you can also hook up to like instant hot water and a generator, of course. So it would run just like a standard natural gas generator. And that's how the big farms are doing it.
Right. That's really interesting. Can we talk about rainwater capture systems?
It's a very simple system. We catch the water off the roof, put it in a 10,000-gallon tank under the garage, and it's sufficient to, well, we've never run out of water. We've never used up actually more than about 3,000 gallons of that before it rains again.
So the cistern is actually located under the floor of the garage?
Yeah, so to visualize it, it's basically the basement or the bottom floor of a single-car garage. It's quite dry here in the summertime, so there's usually rain in April, say, and that will fill up. And then we usually run till, say, October without any significant rain, at which time we'll use about 3,000 gallons for we have a small family, just two people. So we could easily throw in a couple more people and use some more water and not run out. And then when it refills in October, and then we collect our snow on the roof. So when it melts around April, it again refills the system.
Yeah, it sounds really efficient. So why did you decide to pursue these alternative systems?
My wife and I joke about the fact that we've paid for everything in advance. So our electricity, as long as nothing breaks, we've got about a 20 to 30 year solar system, the natural gas system, no user fees for the month. The water is basically free. What I'm saying is that we've got all of the stuff paid in advance. And as we get older and decide to retire, we'll theoretically have no utility bills. Like we have a tax bill, which is reduced by being a farm. And that's about it. Like other than a drum of diesel fuel a year to do some agriculture and clear the driveway, we basically don't have any significant expenses in the future.
Oh, so it lets you be quite independent then.
Yeah, not independent in the sense, you know, because we've made a purposeful decision to connect to BC Hydro. Grids are great. And so instead of going to the effort of having a generator, which I abhor the idea of, we figured we'll just hook up to the grid. And we'll use that as a really big battery.
Yeah, it's a big battery. can you give me an example of something that's really working well for you? I mean, it all sounds like it's working, but is there something that stands out for you that you're quite pleased with?
You know, what I love about it is that it's it just works. For the last 10 years, it's just worked. And that's my favorite thing about it is we might switch things. Like we adjust our solar panels. Almost nobody does that anymore, but we have a summer position and a winter position. Mm-hmm. For example, when we get really deep freezes, there's a little bit of water that collects in our natural gas system, and we can get some days late in the winter around January, February, where things freeze up. So I really need to put in a water filter, a water separator for that.
In the digester, do you mean?
In the hoses is probably the best thing, because like any hot, sweaty thing, the gas that's coming off is damp, and so it will tend to freeze in the lines.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So you almost need a condenser, maybe?
Or? Yeah, basically, there are low-tech water traps, and we should put one of those things in. But after 10 years, and there's like a week a year that the thing won't work sometimes,
right,
if it's really cold.
And has there what's been your biggest challenge?
Initially, it's getting this stuff. Like right now, I can offer you to build a biogas generator, like the digester, for probably about $3,000 worth of concrete. But the molds were about $5,000, and the shipping was about $5,000. Mm-hmm. So it's not an economically viable system if you're doing one. And so far, we've done two. So we've now divided that 10,000 by two, and we're now getting into some, you know, pretty reasonable rates. But the system is designed for about 2,000 copies, right? So in theory, you could do thousands of these things before the molds really were damaged. There's one kind of expendable part, a big plastic dome, which has got the same technology as a canoe, about that same size, about 50 pounds of fiberglass in it. And they have a lifetime around 30 years. So you need one of those for each installation, and you need to replace them theoretically every couple of decades. I saw a number that in China and India, there's about 200 million of these systems, just to give you a rough idea of what the rest of the world's like. Most of them are in hot places. China, India, Africa are big. There's a few in places like Norway here in Canada. And there's also the big commercial ones, like in southern Canada with the dairy farms.
More northern than us.
More northern than us, yeah.
Yeah. So how did you find sourcing the materials for the solar piece?
Well, a lot of this stuff is literally off the shelf. You know, like once you've got the biogas molds, it's just concrete. The solar panels are today really easy to get, even back then. Like we put most of the stuff in 10 years ago. And it was a bit more expensive then, but basically it all still works. Hot water, like a thermal vacuum tube hot water system as well. And that's really nice, but we've been trying to expand that system and we can't get any parts with the whole supply chain thing. It's been 2 years of, hey, can you send us this? Yeah, we should be able to do that. And it doesn't happen. So, you know, that's not really a technology issue. That's just the world today right now.
Right. Is any of that stuff manufactured in Canada, or is it all coming from outside?
You know, I don't think any of it's manufactured here. We bought panels and inverters and stuff, and I think those are all, even though they say Canadian solar on them, I'm almost certain they're Chinese manufacturer. Huh. Very hard to get local stuff.
So if you had a pearl of wisdom for people who might be interested in exploring some of these systems, do you have one in mind?
Pearls. I don't have any pearls. You know, in today's world, you can do an internet search and find the solar PV, photovoltaic, or you can find solar thermal, biogas, like Puxin Tech is the, if you look up Puxin Tech, P-U-X-I-N-T-E-C-H, you would find that and all their information of, like, it's there now. Physically, it's hard to get, but, from a knowledge-based perspective, it's actually really easy to look up on the internet today.
Right. So sourcing the materials might be sort of the biggest
challenge. Sourcing materials is definitely an issue for high efficiency, I think, right now. But it's getting a lot better. Apparently, people now build passive house standard windows in BC here.
Right.
And we imported ours from Austria 10 years ago. So it's fantastic that we don't have to ship that stuff across the ocean anymore.
Brian, thank you very much for coming in and being here and answering all my questions. And I'm grateful that we have people like you that are willing to lead the way and help the rest of us muddle along and sort out how to do things, because, yeah, it's just easier once you see somebody else doing it and inspirational to see how successful it's been.
Yeah. You know, the biggest disappointment in what we're doing is that there's only about four of these similar houses in the area here. Well, probably up to about 10, depending on what you're looking for, but straw bale, high efficiency homes. certainly under a dozen. And we did this 10 years ago, and there's like one a year going up. And I don't know how many houses are going up in Smithers, but everybody else has got a lifetime of natural gas bills ahead of them.
Well, thank you very much again.
Thanks for inviting me on.
Thanks again to my guests, Michelle Roberge and Brian Swansburg, for speaking with me today. This podcast was hosted by Megan Darcy and Michelle Roberge and edited by Pamela Hassan. Our liability waiver was read by Jason Llewellyn, and artwork is by Michelle Roberge. Music for Growing Opportunities is found on the Free Music Archive.
Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Growing Opportunities podcast series. This and other Growing Opportunities podcasts can be accessed through all the major podcast apps and on the RDBN and CICK websites. The link to the RDBN website is rdbn.bc.ca. Have a great day and keep growing.